Would you wear shorts to the office? What if you paired those shorts with a blazer? How about flip-flops with a nice dress? To a wedding. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we discuss what it means to dress appropriately in 2014, particularly with summer upon us. Some see the rising thermostat as an acceptable excuse for loosening collars and maybe a few other wardrobe restrictions. We'll be looking at official and unofficial dress codes in the workplace and elsewhere. Maybe Cole Porter was right. Maybe anything goes. That's coming up on Central Standard, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. I won't claim to be the most knowledgeable person around when it comes to fashion do's and don'ts, but I do try to dress appropriately for the occasion, whatever the occasion may be. And in a world with fewer hard and fast etiquette rules, that's becoming an increasingly challenging proposition. Recently, the Kansas City Star published an article about dressing for the workplace in the summertime, with a headline warning readers not to be flip-floppers or skin turns. That got us thinking about whether there are still rules governing appropriate dress for the workplace and beyond. And if so, what are they? Here to discuss what constitutes appropriate dress in 2014 is Ken Petty, a brand developer with 25 years of experience in the fashion industry. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Shortly, we'll be inviting corporate anthropologist Elizabeth Briety into the conversation. But Ken, I want to hear a little bit more about your background first. You recently moved to Kansas City, or are in transition back to Kansas City, from New York, where you used to work for Calvin Klein. Is that right?
Yes, it was one of the companies I worked for.
When was this?
This was in the 80s, in the sort of vanguard of what you know now as Calvin Klein underwear and the sort of emergence of obsession fragrance. And it was really a big turning point, I think, for fashion, specifically men's fashion in general.
What do you think the turning point represented?
I think the trend you now see, whether you like it or not, where the waistbands of underwear are exposed, sort of giving the public a glimpse of whatever social status you connect your wearing of a particular brand to. It's much more mass now than it was then.
Interesting. Well, how did people at Calvin Klein dress for work? We know what the brand looks like when, you know, it's being sort of sold to consumers, but inside Calvin Klein.
Well, it was really interesting because I remember the first day of what they called your orientation into the company. I sat at a meeting and I happened to throw a jacket over the back of my chair and it exposed a Perry Ellis label at the time. And after the meeting, the president of the company came over to me and he asked me for my sweater and cut the label right out in front of me and said, "You only wear this brand from now on." And they really wanted you to dress exactly the way you saw the advertising sort of present what the brand looked like.
Did that feel oppressive to you?
No, actually, it really, I was familiar with the concept of uniform because of my early years going to a Jesuit high school where you had to wear a shirt and tie, and your tie had to touch the top of your belt buckle, and your hair couldn't touch the back of your collar.
Whoa.
So, particularly for Calvin Klein, there was a sense of uniform dressing and was, you know, sort of expected and quite appropriate because there were retailers and other business people engaging with us in the office, and you had to look like the brand you were selling.
When we make decisions about how we dress, and especially how we dress for work, what are we really doing sort of on a bigger level? We aren't just putting on whatever we can find. And
well, you know, I think what resonates with me is I remember early on in my career, somebody had said to me, "Don't dress like the job you have, dress for the job you want." And I think that there is a way that we assemble our clothing that sends messages out to people to maybe how committed you are, how enthusiastic you are, and just your personal energy is what you're going to bring to a particular company. And I think it sets a serious tone.
The rules of how to dress for any given workplace are sometimes formalized in a written dress code, but more often, it seems like people are left to infer an unspoken dress code or make up their own dress code based on how they want to be regarded by managers, peers, or even underlings internally. So we're constantly puzzling this out. Why is that? Why don't we seem to have explicit, agreed-upon rules for how to dress for the office?
Well, I believe that various companies have corporate culture, and that corporate culture is reflected on the mood and the environment of the workplace and also how the other executives and management people dress. And it's up to the individual to assimilate that and in some way reflect their own personality unless there is a particular code specifically addressed to you in a formal manner.
Do you think that this is kind of a new thing, this aspect of that we come to work with one of our goals being to reflect our own personalities?
Well, it's interesting because snooping around and doing some research, they really claim that in the early 90s and late 90s, the dot-com bubble sort of really gave birth to what is sort of known as Casual Friday. And that was the beginning of casual dress appearing in the workplace. And it just sort of became just a firestorm after that, where the sense of dressing casually just was much more accepted, unless otherwise you're told.
But even Casual Friday isn't casual like what I might wear if I'm, like, throwing on some clothes to walk to the grocery store a block away on a Saturday morning.
It could be, and some people do not have a discerning eye when they're challenged with that. In fact, there's a very funny story. Somebody once told me to sort of promote Casual Friday at IBM. They gave out T-shirts, and the men showed up on Friday with the T-shirts over their shirts and ties because they really didn't know what to sort of – how to adapt after wearing suits and ties their whole career life.
So this idea of how casual is casual –
yeah, I think flip-flops are a no-no unless you're working for a surf brand. If I was a president.
For men and women.
Yeah, for men and women. Yeah,
okay.
I think so. And platform flip-flops or any version of the flip-flop, it's still a beach shoe.
Why? So that's interesting, though. Like, it's as if the toe is this sort of, like, forbidden world.
Well, a manicured toe maybe is passable. But I just think that there's some limits. And again, you know, there would be, specifically in California, and a lot of the Californian-based companies have dress codes that may contradict that. But again, I think it's according to the culture of the business you work for.
We've been focusing a lot on offices as workplaces, but there are lots of other kinds of workplaces. And I'm thinking about, like, if you're going to try and get a job as a barista, there might be some different kinds of unspoken codes about what would be appropriate dress or sort of codified dress for a barista. And that's just one example. But is figuring that out and getting it right part of what identifies you as someone who belongs, who gets it, who speaks the right language, and maybe who would therefore get the job to begin with?
I think that sometimes there are very basic, for lack of a better word, old-fashioned rules that hold true. And I think being clean and being neat and wearing press clothes and, you know, there's so many expressions like you can't look neat if your shoes look beat. And there's nothing more appropriate than a clean white shirt. And I'm a big fan of that.
No matter where you go.
No matter where. I mean, if you're a barista or you're a salesman in a clothing store or a saleswoman, I mean, I just think that there's something to be said looking at, you know, style that derives from uniforms.
I'd like to bring Elizabeth Briety in on this. She's a corporate anthropologist with Cultural Keys, joining us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning.
You've been listening to Ken. What are your thoughts on this? Does the unspoken nature of many of these rules serve a purpose? Is there a reason why we have different rules for different contexts? Or do you agree with Ken that there are certain things that would always be right?
Well, I think that dress is a form of nonverbal communication. So it says a lot about who we are as people. It says a lot about what our identity is. So, for example, if I am working in a manufacturing environment, I'm going to dress a particular way because of that type of workplace. If I am working in a corporate office, I will dress a particular way. If I am in a design studio, I will dress a particular way. So a lot of times your dress is dictated by the kind of job that you do.
The kind of job you do in addition to the kind of company where you work.
Yes. I mean, there are many factors. The way you dress is a function of your work, your status or your rank in the particular company or organization, your age, your gender. I mean, many, many factors contribute to how you dress.
A lot of there are many things I want to tease out in what you just said. Let's talk about age, because you said that your age will influence this. And in a workplace where people are a variety of ages, what does it mean to dress your age? And is that always a good idea?
Well, I'll take my husband as an example. Every morning, he puts on a long sleeve shirt and a tie, and off he goes to work in a corporate environment. Other people who work in that same environment and who are younger than him do not necessarily wear ties, at least on a regular basis.
Does he judge them for that?
No, he just feels comfortable wearing a tie.
But you see, there could be some businesses where, and you mentioned a design firm, so there could be businesses where, in fact, older people might feel some pressure to dress to appear younger than they are, or conversely, some situations where younger employees trying to move up through the ranks might assert their authority or seriousness of purpose by dressing what in a way that would be associated with an older age group.
Well, and you can see that kind of behavior. It's less about age and more about wanting to become a member of that particular culture when you interview for a job. You are typically going to want to look pretty good, whatever that might mean to you. For many people, for a man, it would mean wearing a suit and tie. And for a woman, it probably would mean wearing some kind of a suit or at least a dress or skirt and blouse.
Is it more complicated for one gender than the other? Are these questions simplified in some ways for, I guess, you hear people saying that this is easier to figure out for men. A man puts on a suit and goes to an interview, and a woman has all sorts of other little things to puzzle out. And I'm not sure if that's accurate. I've only been one of those two things. I'd be curious about your perspective on that.
Yes, generally speaking, I think that there is more variation in women's dress and in how people would look at that woman who was dressed for a particular purpose in a particular work environment. You know, women tend to have more clothes. We know culturally that families spend a lot more money on girls than on boys, and a lot of that has to do with how children are dressed.
The Kansas City Star article that inspired this conversation in some ways makes a reference to the phrase skin turns. And I think how much skin a woman is showing or how provocative her dress is perceived to be does play a part in these sort of workplace how to dress dynamics. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Well, an example that happened just the other day, my young neighbor next door was going through her middle school graduation. Her mom had already bought a dress. Then she found out, apparently, that the principal of the school said, there will be no strapless dresses. Well, this girl had a strapless dress. So what to do? Well, in order to get around that rule, the mom came over and asked if I had a needle and thread so that she could sew on some ribbon as straps to make it look like the dress had straps rather than was strapless. And it did the trick.
I've collected a few workplace dress codes, and there is one that makes a reference to the number of inches of thickness that a woman's strap on her shirt must be. Do you think that this issue of straps is a kind of a big deal? I'd like, Ken, maybe you could weigh in on this.
Well, first I'd like to say I think the younger culture, younger generations, say people under 30, and I'll address men first. I think there's a much more of a bigger groundswell in men's fashion than there has ever been. And I think, obviously, the advent of the internet and so many different channels and just the way fashion has become a form of entertainment on multiple networks, that there are other ideas to look at for men. And I do think there's a generation, just citing a meeting I was at the New York Stock Exchange, there were 14 men in the room and they were all dressed alike. So men are followers in the workplace, and there has to be a leader and then the early adapters and then the followers within a company. And for women, I think that, you know, they do have it more difficult, but at the same time, I think that they know that provocative dress can sometimes just bring on certain interaction from peers in workplace and socially that may not be wanted.
That's an interesting idea. That's something that is culturally being discussed a lot in general, whether it is the responsibility of the woman to dress in a way that doesn't elicit that sort of thing, or whether it is the responsibility of the person on the other end of the interaction to sort of...
Well, men should have manners and respect first
right.
off the bat. I mean, and nobody dresses to be sort of shouted out or given any kind of obscene remarks. So, but at the same time, I think that, you know, again, I love the word dress code, because what is the code you are sending out? Like, so the way you assemble your appearance is indicative of what you want to say about yourself, a combination of demographic and psychographic.
So are you kind of like a fan of the dress code?
I always laugh when I see a sign on a door in a resort town that says no shirt, no shoes, no service. I think that, you know, I think that's just a funny way of where, you know, sometimes restrictions and a little bit of discipline is good. I think people being able to express their individuality is really important today.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, here in the studio with Ken Petty and speaking with Elizabeth Bridey through the studios of WDET in Detroit. We're discussing appropriate dress and what it means in 2014 in the workplace, and we'll get a little bit beyond the workplace as well. But I want to stick with the workplace for now because, Elizabeth, something else you mentioned status and rank. Can you
Yes.
unpack that a little bit, how that plays out in how you dress within your workplace?
Well, typically, especially in corporate environments, the more formal the dress, the higher the status of that individual within that company or organization.
So if someone who's like kind of new to the company and not working in a particularly high up position came in very formal attire, would that be seen as over-asserting rank in some way?
No, it would just be seen that that person hasn't absorbed the cultural rules yet.
So
that person is probably a newcomer.
It's interesting because when I think about parental advice to young adult children on their way to the workplace, there's this idea that there's no such thing as overdressing for the workplace, that that the more professionally you are dressed, the better you're going to come across in your workplace. And I kind of hear you saying that that's not quite true.
Well, I think that people want to fit in, and you can't fit in very well if you are dressing so differently from other people. It just makes it very difficult for you. I mean, of course you can do it, but then you have to deal with the aftermath.
Is there kind of a hierarchy that establishes itself through these different ranks and their associated kind of dress and appearance?
Well, I think it's mitigated by other factors, as I was saying, such as what is the culture of the firm. There are some firms where people wear polo shirts and khakis, and that is the norm, and that's typically how people dress, including the most senior leaders of the firm. There are factors related to the kind of work that you're doing. So if you're in a work environment where you really have to get down on your hands and knees, or you're around equipment all day long, you're going to be dressed a particular way, and chances are it's not going to be in a suit.
Yes, that's very true, because I remember having an experience where I was recruited to go to an interview for Gap Banana Republic, and I was working for a fashion corporation where you were expected to wear a suit and tie. And when I went to the interview for Gap Banana Republic, the human resource person kind of looked at me in kind of a judgy way and said, you know, is that how you dress every day? And it was the brand was kind of new in their reinvention. And I realized after that interview that I was overdressed, or maybe sort of wasn't going to fit in or look like an easy merge into their culture.
That's interesting. In the research that I was doing for the show, I noticed that there's a phrase, startup casual. And one of the pieces of advice that I was reading online, just imagining that I was a person looking for a job at one of these trendy startups, that the advice they're giving is, whatever you do, don't show up for this interview in a suit. You'll be showing that you don't get it or coming across as uptight.
I think also there is, you know, we're much more of a visual culture than we ever have been. And I think that Instagram and Facebook have sort of, you know, propelled that forward. And
branding ourselves.
Right. Yes, exactly. And I think that, you know, there's a whole movement to not fitting in, to not want to blend in, to go every way you can to sort of stick out and be an individual. And that there are two kind of corporate cultures that collide, depending on how old the business is and depending on how new the company is. And they're sort of laws of what's right and appropriate shift. And I think that a younger person does not want to blend in any way. They're still fighting for individuality.
There are some professions where it seems like this would affect different professions kind of unevenly, and that there might be some that are more complicated than others. I was doing some informal research asking my friends about how they dress for work, and a friend who's a piano tuner had a really interesting kind of conundrum that he's showing up at people's homes and wants to look nice and presentable. They're letting him in there, but that he's going to maybe, as he put it, end up with 100-year-old dust on himself. So sort of compromise is nice attire with a meaningful apron.
Well, you know, I think that there's two ways to maybe split this, that there's appropriate dress and there's fashion, and they battle in the workplace, because appropriate dress can be a navy suit and a white shirt and tie. But that's, you know, and there are fashionable interpretations of that, and that's where pushing the envelope or crossing the line can come in.
Elizabeth, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analogy. But what I was thinking of actually was a work environment where you have much less flexibility. A hospital.
Good example.
Typically, the way hospitals work is that depending on what your role is in that hospital, you are required to dress a certain way. So physicians are typically associated with the lab coat. If they are seeing, you know, just sort of going around doing rounds. If they're in surgery, they're in scrubs.
I'd like to talk about the lab coat, actually. Can we stop there for just a second? Because that is a really interesting thing. I can't imagine that the lab coats in the present day really serves that much of a purpose in a patient visit. I mean, it does appear to have roomy pockets, which I think would be convenient. But the white lab coat, you know, it's probably, I don't think it's needed to perform any particular function. It seems like it's not keeping someone safe, but it signifies something really important.
Yes, first of all, it does keep whatever you're wearing underneath it clean. Particularly if you have to deal with a wound or you know, some other problem associated with your patient.
But however, then white would be the least convenient color for that.
That's true. But white, for whatever reason, has come to be associated with physicians who are seeing patients.
I think that's
it. And so it tells... Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, continue.
So it basically signals this person is a physician. And that's very important in a hospital. Because in hospitals, we are going there because we are sick, and sometimes very sick. And so you need to be able to quickly identify who are the physicians. And the white coat does that very nicely.
I think the lab coat's an interesting article to discuss, because I think how it's been appropriated or repurposed by branding companies, particularly you can walk through the main floor of a department store and see the woman behind the clinique counter in a lab coat. She's far from a surgeon. But I think that what it communicates is, to what you were saying, is that there's a professional, clinical, pure, official seriousness it brings to any brand. And you'll see the lab coat repurposed even in estheticians when you go get a facial or even a manicure, because there's something that gives out a code of hygienic and clean and, I think, the sense of officiality.
I did pick up the code of dress for the School of Pharmacy and Nursing at UMKC, and it is a very extensive dress code with a lot of copy in it. I mean, it's almost a treatise on pride in this profession. I'm going to read a little selection from this. Pharmacy and nursing are some of the oldest and most respected professions. Patients trust their nurses or pharmacists as sources of medical information and depend on them to act in their best interest while providing safe and accurate nursing and pharmaceutical services. Each student inherits this time-honored legacy as part of their profession and is obligated by oath to its preservation and enhancement. Throughout history, health professions have adopted standards of attire, and it kind of goes on from there. It's really very impassioned. It's, but what about this issue of pride in your profession, letting people know you care, preserving the name of all people in your profession?
I like the sense of people taking pride in their work. It exemplifies enthusiasm and commitment, and I think that it's needed. I'm a big fan of the lab coat. I think it works, and it sets a standard, and it presents a sense of authority and who's in charge.
You're making me want to wear a lab coat.
I'm going to buy one after this.
Elizabeth Briety, what do you think? Pride in profession as related to how you dress when you present yourself at your workplace, whatever your workplace may be.
Well, some occupations do not necessarily have a formal form of dress. Those that do, or those kinds of even, you know, community associations that we belong to out in society may have a dress code. For example, the Boy Scouts have a certain dress code depending on, you know, your age and your the number of badges that you've achieved and so on. Ken mentioned a moment ago how he went to a Jesuit high school. There, too, there is a uniform dress code.
Well, we're going to hear more about the many dress codes, spoken and unspoken, out there in your communities, your workplaces and beyond, maybe your neighborhoods, your hangouts. Call us at 816-235-2888. Tell us whether there are still rules that govern how you dress. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back after this break. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Ken Petty, who's a brand consultant in the process of moving to Kansas City, and Elizabeth Briety, who works for Cultural Keys, a corporate anthropology firm in Detroit. We're talking about what it means to dress appropriately in 2014, who sets the rules, and who does and doesn't follow them. We want to know what rules govern how you dress and who sets them. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That number again is 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us. Our handle is at KCURCST. And before we went to break, Ken, we were all talking, in fact, about that there are lots of kinds of small associations, whether they're formal or informal. Elizabeth was mentioning the Boy Scouts, for example, that have their own rules of dress. Could you talk a little bit about that? You've lived in New York for a long time, and I'm thinking about the different neighborhoods and different communities in New York, how they maybe identify themselves through dress.
Well, I think when I first moved to New York, it was in 1983, and excuse me, the most evident style of dress splitting the city was this term that had begun to be thrown around, that she or he was very downtown. And I had lived uptown at that point. And really what they were talking about was the emergence of the all-black wardrobe, and that downtown was significant of alternative lifestyles, alternative music, alternative fashion, just a way of life in the city that was not New York mainstream.
There are now neighborhoods. I'm thinking of a neighborhood in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, where if you say that someone is dressing in a style that's very Williamsburg, I think throughout the United States people recognize what that means. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what everybody's now referring to, or marketers refer to, as the new hipster. But I see that here in Kansas City. I see it in the Crossroads, you know. I mean, I think one of my favorite places is Oddly Correct, and I just love the way everybody looks in there. Not only do they have great coffee, but, you know, interesting. interestingly, I've just attended the West 18th Street Fashion Show here and have been to many fashion shows in New York. And this was such a great exhibit of bringing fashion to the street and just looking at the crowd, which was so diverse in age and gender. And most significantly, the style of dress that people wore to this fashion show.
Do you think that people were dressed for this event in a way that was different from how they dress in their day-to-day?
There were some, definitely, that, you know, put on the Ritz, so to speak, to attend the show. And there were some people that were dressed very casual, like they would in going to any other event in their life, or non-event, for that matter.
Elizabeth Bridie, I want to talk to you also about this idea of the rules that govern how we dress for social situations, not just for the workplace. I'm thinking about specifically weddings. I think, you know, nowadays, if you don't put on the wedding how you want people to dress, they are not going to know.
Yes, I think that's a good point. People need some guidance. I think the most famous wedding is worth talking about, which was Prince William and Kate Middleton's wedding. And there, the American media had a good laugh about all the hats that the ladies were wearing attending the wedding. And the more outrageous looking the hat, the more it was derided. And interestingly, what's going on there culturally is that Americans, as a rule, don't have much tolerance for hats. Hats, on the other hand, in Britain, really complete the outfit. They make the outfit what it is. They match well. It's the dress and the shoes and the hat all go together as a complete set, and they make a statement about who you are. Whereas in America, with two exceptions, women, two important exceptions, women don't tend to wear hats.
What are those exceptions?
Well, one exception, African-American women typically wear hats to church on Sundays. That's one exception. And the second exception is the Kentucky Derby.
Whoa. Okay. So there's one day out of the year when collectively as a country we like hats.
Yes, exactly. And this business about following the rules. There was one person who did not wear a hat to Prince William's wedding, at least that was picked up by the media, and that was Samantha Cameron, Prime Minister Cameron's wife. And she, too, was derided in the British press for not following the rules.
So there are rules. We aren't always told what they are. Is that kind of a particular conundrum of our era, or has that always been true? And part of what kind of outs you as not being an insider is that you didn't know the rule.
Well, I'm sure she knew the rule. She's British.
So what does it mean that she didn't follow it?
It meant that she was making a statement that she did not want to follow the rule. And because of her status in society, at some level, she was able to get away with it.
And I think she trumped the media as well, because it was highly noted in that swarm of hats. She was a step out notation, mm-hmm. so to speak. So it was good press for her.
That's interesting. Yep. We've got a line full of calls, so I'll go ahead and take some of those. If you want to be one of our callers, 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And we've got Cindy in Kansas City, Missouri on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I just have a question for the panel about back to the medical professionals. I'm a nurse in the Kansas City area, and most of the healthcare institutions in the city still require that a nurse or a nursing assistant cover a tattoo with a bandage if it's visible with their uniform on. And I just wondered what the opinion of that was here in 2014.
All right, let's hear about tattoos in the workplace, maybe first in the medical profession, as Cindy's talking about, but maybe beyond that, too, because I think that it's a fashion accessory you can't really take off. So, Elizabeth.
Well, tattoos are a form of body art, again, a form of nonverbal communication. They say something about the person. And when you are working in certain kinds of workplaces, tattoos are not viewed positively. So in this case, the solution apparently was to put a Band-Aid on top of the tattoo that would otherwise be visible. Sounds like a way that the hospital had of adjusting to the fact that at least one of its employees, and probably many, have tattoos.
It's interesting to me that in a healthcare setting where you would think that maybe a wound would be more alarming than a tattoo, you know, like seeing your healthcare practitioner bandaged up could have an effect of being alarming in and of itself, that a tattoo is more unsavory than a wound. Ken?
I would never judge anybody who has a tattoo. It doesn't mean anything to me, regardless if they do or they don't. And I don't see any need for it to be covered with a bandage. It's part of who somebody is. And if that person's in a medical profession, they obviously bring an enormous amount of education and skill set to their job. And a tattoo doesn't sort of delete that for me.
What do you think about that, Elizabeth?
Well, I think people make choices with their lives, and then they have to accept what comes down the pike in terms of future employers. Some employers are going to be quite open to tattoos and other forms of piercing and body art, and others are not.
Okay, let's hear from Megan and Lawrence. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just we were talking about what your articles of clothing say about you in the workplace. And I used to teach in a school district in Kansas City, and I'm kind of an old teacher. I like my comfy flats. You know, I'm on my feet all day, getting on the floor. And it was interesting as the district started hiring these young women to become principals and in leadership roles, they all started wearing 3-inch heels. And I started to wonder how that works, because you'd see them take off down the hall chasing after a kid in these humongous heels. And it was obvious that this was something they were trying to say to us about power or authority, because they all started wearing them. And a couple other teachers in the district would adopt this practice of the 3-inch heel, but I couldn't imagine anything more uncomfortable when you're on your feet all day.
So that's interesting. And it all started at one time, or one person started doing it and then another followed and so forth?
You know, I think it might have come from the superintendency. I think it might have come higher up the rank as more and more women were taking these power positions. But it did make us scratch our heads a little bit.
Interesting. I wonder what Elizabeth Bridie might have to say about that.
I guess I would say it's not a very practical adaptation to that work environment.
Have you seen, Elizabeth, have you seen other work environments adapt, like one member of the team starts dressing a little differently and others followed? Have you seen that work and take hold?
Yes. I worked at General Motors for much of my career in the research labs. And back in the mid to late 80s, women were expected there to wear suits. And we had one quite cold winter. One of the women that I worked with was thin, and she was just cold all the time. And she decided, instead of wearing a suit, meaning a jacket with a skirt and blouse, she was going to wear a jacket, blouse, and pair of pants. Well, this had not been done before in that workplace, to our knowledge, and we had conversations about it. And finally she said, you know what, I'm going to do it. So she did it. And pretty soon, other women started taking her lead. You know, that's one way in which workplaces do adapt. It's one person starts something, and then others will follow and mimic the same pattern.
How did the leadership within General Motors respond to that? Was it just sort of a non-issue?
It was a non-issue totally, because she looked, you know, it was a very nice pantsuit. She looked good, and she made the case. Look, it's freezing cold out.
Elizabeth, you work for Cultural Keys, a corporate anthropology firm in Detroit. You have this background with General Motors. Can you talk to us about what you do at a corporate anthropology firm?
Yes, this is my own consulting business, and I am most of the work that I do is helping organizations change. So I focus on firms and organizations that want to both improve their work culture, increase how effective their partnership relationships are. And then I also do work in the medical field where I'm working on trying to help enhance healthcare satisfaction.
When you talk about workplaces that want to change, especially their work culture, how does the way people dress play into that? Do employers come to you sometimes talking about that they wish people would dress differently?
That is not really a very salient or important part of at least the initial conversations that I have with clients. Usually it's more along the lines, I'll give you an example of a hospital that I did some work for. They said, look, we would really like to become more patient-centric. How do we do that?
And does dress end up becoming part of the conversation later, or is this just sort of like a niche topic?
I think it's really a niche topic. I think that there are more fundamental aspects of how the organization works and runs and the customers it serves or the suppliers that it has to deal with that take precedence. The dress is an outward sign to those customers and suppliers and publics about what that organization is or stands for or expects. So it's important, but it's typically not the reason that a client would come to me seeking help.
Ken, does that surprise you coming from inside the fashion industry?
Well, I really do think it, you know, it depends on the business, because I think more than ever now, the way people dress within an organization is the theater of the brand or the business.
The theater of the brand. I like that phrase. Explore it a little.
So when I'll take a store like Dean & DeLuca, and when you go in there and the people behind the counter just look a specific way that looks like they're sort of epicurious professionals, so to speak, where, you know, it gives you a sense that it's not the normal grocery store person. And I think the same way when Starbucks opened on to the landscape in America, they just looked different than the local diner coffee server then. And I think that, and specifically in fashion, companies are very heavy image-driven businesses. The way people look within that company is as much a part of the brand and resonates with the consumer, with the retailer who's purchasing their product, that it's all part of brand messaging.
Ken, as a fashion person, is there an industry that you think has a particular look that is interesting to explore?
Well, I think, you know, well, they always joke around about the fashion industry. You know, they preach color and practice black. You know, there still is very much, you know, a double standard for the insiders, so to speak, than, you know, what they're curating in magazines and so forth.
That's so funny. Okay, let's talk to Susan in Gladstone. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment to the gentleman about, he was talking about when he showed up at Banana Republic, Gap Banana Republic. And my reaction is that I have one single voluntary moment to make a first impression. I always dress up for an interview. However, I always let him know, I can dress to dress code. I can dress down.
How do you create the opportunity to say that?
Well, I kind of, at the end of my questions, when they say, do you have any questions, I'll always say, no, but I have a couple of statements if you don't mind. And they'll say, okay. And that's when I say, you may think I don't fit for your model. However, I can always dress to your model. I can't come in not knowing what your model is and dress down.
So you acknowledge the unacknowledged things in interviews.
I do. I always say things like, I own a dictionary and I know how to use it. A lot of people, you know, depend on Word's dictionary. Well, you're not always going to get it right then.
Well, so this is interesting.
Those are the things that I address.
And first impressions are kind of what we're talking about when we talk about dress. It could be the case that once you've been with a company for many years, how you dress at least internally, is less important. People already, in theory, respect you for what you do, know your work, know you take it seriously. A first impression is a little different. Do you think that's right, Elizabeth Bridie?
Yes, I do. Any person who hopes to become part of a new work environment should do basic homework. And part of that homework is learning about the organization and speaking to people, if possible, who work there or who know of people who work there to get a feel for it, checking out websites, etc. However, the cultural rules are typically flexible enough so that when the person comes for the interview, it's usually okay for the person to be, as someone might have said earlier, overdressed.
I read, when I was preparing for the show, kind of a funny article that I think was, again, geared toward this startup industry. But it was, the headline was something like, is it okay to wear flannel to the boardroom? And the guy who wrote the article starts out by acknowledging that he himself has worn flannel into a boardroom. But then he acknowledges who is in the boardroom, how well he already knows them, what it is he's just been doing, and how well the people in that room understand it. And then he kind of makes the point that even Zuckerberg has been known, even someone very known for wearing T-shirts and dressing down in formal situations, will put on a suit for investors when the time is right. This idea that trust in investment, are there industries where you have to dress differently for different audiences and especially for investors than you might dress in other contexts? Elizabeth?
When you are meeting the public, so to speak, engaging with either your customers, your suppliers, your patients, whoever they might be, you want to make sure that you present the image, a positive image, and a positive image of the organization that you represent, because now you are considered, your identity as an individual is tied directly to the place where you work. So you want to put that, you know, first foot forward in a good way. And since the first thing that people will notice is typically dress, you want to make sure you are dressed appropriately based on the firm that you work for.
I do think it depends on your audience. And I'm a believer that sometimes it doesn't matter what you wear, it's how you wear it. And flannel can work in a boardroom under a tweed blazer with a tie. I've seen it done, and I think I might have done it myself. And sometimes a younger audience wants to sort of identify with you. So if you're wearing a linen suit with a great sneaker and a T-shirt, then you want the attention of a younger person and you're not within their age group. There are certain ways where it kind of levels the playing field a little bit and you can get their attention. And then if you're in a certain situation where you're dealing with financial people or real estate people and you know that they're older and more seasoned and they're going to look at you for your age and experience, you might want to assimilate that particular culture of dress for that particular moment.
The ability to assimilate these different cultures of dress requires that you're paying attention. And is this sort of a test on some level? Are there situations that where how you dress is kind of a test of how closely you've been paying attention?
I think so. You know, I think most job interviews are like auditions. And, you know, in the end, personality and skill set wins. And I think that a style of dress can always be curated. So that, first and foremost, is most important. Experience rises to the top. And I think personality and enthusiasm is really important. And some people need a little coaching to on how to dress for a particular job. And that's fair.
Is that something that you do as part of your brand consulting business? Do you talk to people about how they dress?
I'm recently involved in a project that I'll help them develop a sense of style and standards with everything, how people will speak and greet within this company, and also the sort of suggested parameters of a style of dress that really reflects what the brand is sort of presenting itself as.
You mentioned earlier in the show that a clean, pressed, nice white shirt, you just can't go wrong. Is there something where you really could not go right? You mentioned the flip-flop. Anything else? Just universal no?
I just think a baseball cap is a no-no in a business situation. I think it's funny now you even see, nightlife and clubs curate their crowd And it's interesting to see outside of specific doors where we'll say no baseball caps, no hoodies, no sneakers.
What do you think is really going on there?
They want to offer their patrons a higher experience. They can see that anywhere on the street. And, you know, the media projects these sort of imagery and icons of what glamorous, exciting, groundbreaking nightlife is about. And there's no baseball cap and hoodie maybe in that image they want to project.
Do you think that there's in any way a sense of saying who belongs here and who doesn't belong here? Or is it anyone belongs, just take off your hat because we want to look like
the I think it's if you want to belong, take off your hat and no gold chains or whatever they say, you know. I think it's part of not only for that person that needs to take their cap off, but it's really inviting you into a experiential environment where you're sort of surrendering yourself to their experience.
Elizabeth, what do you think, what would you advise to people who are trying to figure out the rules of an environment and how to dress for it, and they're just totally on the outside? What's a good first step toward finding your way through that process?
I think you tune up your powers of observation. You pay a lot of attention to, if it's dress, what people are wearing, and you ask people, and people will give you tips. Or you will hear people talking about what is considered acceptable and what is considered unacceptable.
Do you have any special pet peeves when it comes to ways people are maybe now breaking what used to be rules? Any pet peeves?
Well, culture evolves, and so it's not my rules that matter, but since we're talking about workplaces. It's the workplace rules, and as long as you know you, as long as there are people, people will try to push the boundaries. They will try to innovate, be creative, etc. And slowly but surely, dress and accessories will change.
Well, that's all the time we have for this conversation about appropriate dress in 2014. Thanks so much to Ken Petty and Elizabeth Briady. It was a pleasure talking with you both.
Thank you.
Ken is a brand consultant living in Kansas City, and Elizabeth Briady works for Cultural Keys, a corporate anthropology firm in Detroit. Tomorrow, we'll take a different kind of look at our city's pollen count. We'll talk to the man who actually counts the pollen. Later in the show, we'll explore what it would take for Kansas to get out of the drought. After every rain, we hear it's not enough. What does that mean? Join us tomorrow. To listen back to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.